I think 5% for the coming years, I'm confident. It's because for several reasons. One, China still has a growth potential around 8%. And secondly, China is a large economy. You know, every year, although exporting market is very important, but more than 80% of our productions consumes in domestic market. I'm confident that, you know, if it's not 2025, it'll be 2026, that we can cross the threshold to become a high-income country. So it will be a big milestone in human history. The possibility for China to make this transformation within one generation, two generations, will enhance their confidence. If they have the right idea, right policy, and to have a coordinated, concerted effort in their country, they can achieve similar things. So it can enhance the confidence of other developing country as well.
The Chat Lounge.
Chat Lounge.
Chat Lounge.
The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
Welcome to the Chat Lounge. I'm Tu Yun. China's economy has achieved a better-than-expected performance, growing by 5.3% in the first quarter over the number recorded a year ago. This result comes amid continuous Western predictions such as China's 40-year boom is over, China's economic prospects go from bad to worse, and China's doom is at hand. How has China shrugged off all the doomsayers and achieved the steady growth it needs over the past few decades? As China faces another turning point in its economic development, can it make a smooth transition towards high-quality development driven by new quality productive forces? For the answers to these and other questions on China's economic development, I had an exclusive interview with former World Bank chief economist Justin Ifu Lin. Professor Lin is now Dean of the Institute of New Structural Economics and Dean of the Institute of South-South Cooperation and Development at Peking University. Thank you, Professor Lin, for joining the chat. So you said earlier this year, as long as the Chinese economy maintains an annual growth rate of some 5% or above, the country will cross the threshold of $13,000 per capita GDP and become a high-income country by 2026. That's in 2 years. There are some people who remain doubtful over this. So why are you so confident?
Well, the first that, you know, to be a high-income country, the threshold is 13,800.
All right.
And now we are 12,600.
So that's 1,200.
About 1,200.
Disparity, right?
Yeah, disparity. And so, you know, and if we maintain about 5% growth, since our population growth now is almost zero, so our per capita GDP increase will be about 5%. For example, last year our growth rate was 5.2%, but per capita GDP growth rate was 5.4%. And so if we maintain a 5% growth for 2 years, then we can reach the threshold of 13,800. And I think that I'm sure that we will be able to maintain the growth rate. And that's the reason why I'm confident that, you know, if it's not 2025, it'll be 2026, that we can cross the threshold to become a high-income country. And it will be very significant in the world, because so far, only about 16% of population live in a high-income country. And if China becomes a high-income country, you know, our population is 18% of the global population.
Right.
So the people living in high-income country will be more than doubled.
Right.
So it will be a big milestone in human history.
Indeed, that's what we are looking forward to. But what makes you believe that China is able to avoid the so-called middle-income trap faced by many other emerging economies like Malaysia, like Brazil, like Argentina?
Well, you know, first, middle income trapped is not destiny.
All right.
Right. And we understand the so-called middle income trap is that you are not able to grow faster than the advanced country.
Mm-hmm.
The advanced country, their per capita GDP growth rate is only average about 2% per year. And so for a middle income country, you want to close the gap to reach the high income stages, you need to grow faster than the advanced country. And so if you can grow at 3%, 4%, 5%, then you will be able to narrow the gap. You can cross the threshold.
Mm.
And as we just discussed, I think that China will be able to maintain in a 5 and above in the coming years. And with that, certainly, we are not only can cross the threshold of the high income, we can also further narrow down the income gap with the advanced country.
That's provided everything goes as we expect, right? But with the current geopolitical situation around the world, do you think there might be some, you know, accident or anything unexpected that may happen in the years to come that may affect, yeah, you know, the 5% GDP growth target?
Well, certainly China is a large country.
Right.
China is the largest exporting country in the world, so our growth will be affected by the global economic situation.
Right.
Yeah. And but I think 5% for the coming years, I'm confident. It's because for several reasons. One, China still has a growth potential around 8%.
Right.
Okay. And secondly, China is a large economy. Our domestic market is so large because, you know, every year, although exporting market is very important, but more than 80% of our productions consumes in domestic
mm-hmm.
market. And so just like we are like big air carriers, as long as we can do our things right and use our domestic market, and we can tap into that 8% growth potential to achieve around 5% growth. And if the global economy is better, then we can grow more than 5%, even reach 6% or more.
Right.
But even we encounter some challenges from outside, but rely on our large domestic circulation,
mm.
we can, you know, maintain this growth momentum continuously.
Mm. So when, you know, the government work report says that China is able to achieve 5% in its economic growth, actually the decision makers are being conservative, right?
From my point of view,
right?
It's being conservative because we have the 8% potential, but we only say about 5%.
All right.
And that because certainly the external growth, external global development is not fully under our control.
Right.
And also we have to, you know, to pursue other target. For example, we need to, you know, cope with the global warming. We want to peak our carbon emission by 2030, and we want to have a carbon neutrality by 2060.
Mm.
For that, we need to green our economy. And those kind of effort can make our economy green, but in terms of its contribution to the growth will be minimal.
Right.
And so that we need to, you know, moderate a little bit growth from the potential. However, I think that we take all the consideration into this formula, I'm sure we still have the possibility to achieve 5% and more.
Now I understand why Kishore Mahbubani
yeah.
would say that when you look at China, you'd better overestimate its economic growth instead of underestimate it.
Right.
The Chat Lounge. The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
China has developed from one of the least developed countries in the world to a major driving force contributing some 30% to global growth annually on average over the past decade. Yeah. So what would you say is the most difficult part in this transformation, and what's the key, in your opinion, to achieving the transformation?
Well, transformation is not easy at any time, at any stage of development, because, you know, other countries, they have the same aspiration, and they also, you know, have the same, you know, war situation, and but they are not able to achieve what we have achieved. And I think that so transformation is always challenging. But the reason why we can, you know, maintain stability and dynamic economic growth, I think because we have a good guiding principle. First, we understand, yes, at any time, we always have many challenges. But the way to overcome the challenges is to pursue development. Development is the hard truth.
Right.
Growth is the hard truth. With growth, with the development, we will be able to generate more resources, more better condition to address the issue we have. And we address the issue, the difficulty we have now, and we make a progress. We are going to have new, you know, new challenges, new issues. But even we face new challenges and issues, we cannot stop there. We need to find way to, you know, continue to grow, to development, and in order to be able to, you know, generate more better condition for addressing the problem. So from what I see, sometimes we say, well, we achieve so much, so that must be easy to achieve. No, actually, they are not easy to achieve. And that's the reason why China is such a, you know, outstanding country, because in the same period of time, we were able to, you know, achieve such a remarkable growth. And those remarkable growth certainly allow us to have a better condition. But even with a better condition, we are going to have new challenges.
You said a lot of other countries also want to achieve what China has achieved, but they obviously haven't been able to do that. So why China? Why it is China instead of other countries has achieved this miracle?
I think that, you know, because I think that fundamentally in China, we have a saying, 思路决定出路.
Right.
Yeah. That means right ideas will help you to overcome the challenges.
All right.
Yeah. And we are lucky to have the leadership. They understand the reality of China, and they did ask to, you know, overcome the difficulties with policy measures which are suitable for the Chinese condition, and did ask to, you know, overcome the challenges and to make a progress.
Is it just because, you know, we are lucky to have the right leadership, or is there any other, you know, more deeper-rooted reasons?
I think that one thing that certainly the Chinese intellectuals, Chinese leadership, share the same goal to lead us to have the national rejuvenation, that commitment. And also throughout, they are guided by the, you know, Marxist ideas, you know, materialism, material dialectical, and that means, you know, you need to find out what is your economic base, and this is also consistent with Chinese traditional, you know, philosophy, traditional culture, 实事求是, fighting truth from the facts,
right?
Not fighting truth from the book. I think those kind of philosophical principle, plus the commitment to, you know, contribute to the national rejuvenation, and that allow us to have the leadership generation by generation to lead us to make the progress.
Indeed. Over the past few decades, there have been repeated predictions over China's economy. Is that risk of collapse?
Yeah.
So, was there any moment when the economy was actually on the brink, but was pulled back eventually?
I think that first, the reason why there's the repeated forecast about the coming collapse of the Chinese economy. And it has been, proposed and several times,
right.
But none of them realized. I think the main reason is because China's transition, based on Chinese reality, according to Chinese, challenges and what resources we can have, and we have a transition path, which is different from the mainstream theories. And so from the mainstream theories, our policy may not be right. And so they often predict, since your policy is not right, and it's going to get you into trouble. And when our economic growth rate was high, certainly those kind of theory will not be popular. But whenever our economic growth rate is slowing down, because we certainly have some kind of cycles.
Right.
Sometimes we grow faster, sometimes we grow slower. Only average we have 9%, but not every year 9%. So whenever your growth rate drops, people will say, well, because you did not follow those kind of mainstream theory, and they think those theories are right, and you did not follow that, so you create those kind of trouble. At that time, they will predict you're going to collapse. However, as I mentioned, those kind of theory may not be suitable for us, because those kind of theory generated from the experiences in the advanced country. And those kind of theory implicitly use the condition in the advanced country as their assumptions, their premise. And so if you use those kind of theory in our countries, they may not work. And if we want to have some policy which work, we need to base on our reality.
Right.
Yeah. And based on our reality, that will be effective, but certainly it does not mean we can maintain the growth on the average every year the same.
Mm-hmm.
And so we are going to have sometimes higher growth, sometimes lower growth due to the external condition and some new challenge in our country. And that is the reason why they may predict that, we are going to encounter big difficulties and China may fall apart. That is the reason why we often hear those kind of China collapse predictions.
Right.
And in terms of the challenges, certainly in the process we have all kind of difficult challenges. For example, in the late 1990s, early 2000, at that time East Asian economies, they encountered a financial crisis.
Right.
And the main reason for the financial crisis was their banking sectors had a lot of non-performing loans. For example, the East Asian financial crisis started in Thailand. And the non-performing loans in Thailand reached about 15%, and then it spread to other East Asian economy country, and similarly, they all have very high non-performing loans. But their non-performing loan was about 15%. But in 2000, according to official statistics, our non-performing loan was 25%, much higher than the crisis hit countries.
Right.
And according to some scholars' research, our non-performing loan could be as high as 40%. And that's the reason why at that time people also predict China is going to collapse. But how come we overcome that?
Right.
Growth. You know, we maintain stability, and we use some policy measures to set up asset management companies, separate the non-performing loan from the banking sectors. And at the same time, we maintain dynamic economic growth. So as a result, now our banking sector's non-performing loan is only about 1%, much lower than the global average, about 3%. So that's what I said. The way to address the problem, the challenges, to understand the roots of the problem, and find out some measures which are suitable, are consistent with our condition. So at that time, we set up asset management companies and inject some fiscal resources to separate that. And then we maintain dynamic economic growth. Mm. Then our banking sector now is quite healthy.
Right.
So that's what I said, you know, development, growth is right. The hard truth. It's the way to address, you know, almost any problem in our country.
So you are saying that China has never been to such a situation where there is one more step ahead, we will be falling into some abyss. Never been in such a situation.
Well, it depends. If we do not have good policy measures, then we can encounter some crisis like in other East Asian countries. As I said, in Thailand, their non-performing loan was 15%. Mm. Ours was higher than that.
Yeah.
And also Korea, ours was higher than that. But at the time, we maintained some measure. For example, we did not liberalize our financial sectors. So allow the government, you know, to have the ability to stabilize the market and allow the, you know, the speculation, the global speculators will not be able to, you know, take advantage of our condition and causing the collapse of our banking sectors. So certainly, you know, we understand the challenges and we want to overcome that, but we also need to adopt some kind of measure which are consistent with the condition we have.
Mm. But now our banking sector or the financial sector is open, you know, wider to the outside. So does that mean we're facing higher risks, especially when there is an economic crisis?
And the one thing, as I mentioned, our non-performing loan ratio is among the lowest in the world.
All right.
That is one. Secondly, we liberalize, but at the same time, we continue to have management, you know. The inflow and outflow of short-term capitals, we still have some management. And that will give us some buffer zone.
This has been the Chat Lounge. When we come back, we'll check out the most significant challenge China will have to face when making a transition towards high-quality development driven by new quality productive forces with Professor Justin Evelyn.
Sideline Story brings you all things sports related. The hottest topics, latest events, juiciest stories, all with a very personal take. Subscribe to Sideline Story Podcast for heated sports discussions covering events that are happening in China and around the world.
Welcome back to the Chat Lounge. We're chatting about China's economy with Professor Justin Evelyn, former World Bank Chief Economist, and Dean of the Institute of New Structural Economics and Dean of the Institute of South-South Cooperation and Development at Peking University. Now that China faces another turning point in its economic development, what is the biggest challenge in making a smooth transition towards high-quality development driven by new quality productive forces then?
Well, you know, certainly we need to have innovations in order to raise our productivities. And there are two ways for innovation.
Mm.
One is in the traditional sectors, we are still catching up. And for that, we have latecomers advantages. Yeah. And the other one certainly is in the fourth industrial revolution, the new industry, new emerging industry, and some future industries.
Mm.
And new technology, some future technologies. For that, I think we also have some advantages. We have a large population. We have a large talent pool.
Right.
And that is a very important determinant for innovation. Secondly, we have a large domestic market. And so any new innovation, they can reach the large market. They can, you know, realize their economy scales and to make them very competitive.
Mm.
Also, we have the most complete industrial sectors.
Right.
And so any kind of innovations, if they need to have certain input, and domestically we can produce that. So with those kind of advantages, I think we can also be competitive in the new economies. And that is the reason why I think China has 8% growth potential. And those kind of innovation, no matter it depends on the latecomers' advantages or in these new industries, new economies, and we can raise productivity by innovation, and that is the new, you know, new source of growth, new productivity, you know, novel productivities.
Right. You talked about a talent pool of China, but what we are seeing now is quite a number of top-tier, I would say, talent going overseas to some other developed countries to work or live there. So what would be your suggestion for, you know, to keep those talent after their graduation? You know the situation, right?
Well, we need to be open because, you know, if we want to compete on the global frontiers, certainly we also need to acquire those kind of new scientific achievement in the foreign country to understand that.
Right.
But as long as we can maintain this dynamic economic growth, we will have more opportunities for R&D, more opportunity for the business development, and more opportunity for innovation in, you know, natural sciences and also in the social sciences.
Mm.
And I think then those kind of opportunities attract talent to stay and to come back. I'm sure in the future, we are not only to attract our talents to stay, we will attract talents from other countries to work in our country. For example, Huawei now employ a lot of scientists.
Right, from Russia, from Ukraine. Russia,
from Ukraine, not only so, also from the US.
Right.
Yeah.
Hopefully, the more they come, the better. But most of those talents, I think they're now concentrated on the advanced technology area, right? So what are the chances of China becoming the top player in what's believed to be the fourth industrial revolution characterized by emerging technology advances in such as in robotics, in artificial intelligence, or autonomous vehicles?
Well, here's that. Actually, we already, in some areas, we are global leaders.
Right.
In terms of fourth industrial revolution, electronic vehicles is one, you know, of this fourth industrial revolution. We now are global leaders.
Yes.
Solar panels, that is also one of the items in the fourth industrial revolution. We are global leaders. So we already achieved that, some. But certainly there are some areas we are competing with advanced countries.
Mm.
In terms of artificial intelligence or robotics, we are quite close. Certainly we still have some gap, but I think if we maintain this, you know, effort, we can catch up and reach the same level, you know, and in the future even lead in the new directions.
Mm.
So it's a process.
Right.
And we have the talents, and we have the will, we have the resources, and put on our effort, I'm sure we will not be, you know, lagging behind.
Mm, you're quite optimistic. You're an optimist, obviously. But what about, you know, containment from other countries, especially, you know, the vehicles, or the autonomous vehicles sector? Europe, the United States, they're taking measures to, you know, try to contain China's leadership, I would say, in this sector.
Well, you know, because the best is to open for us and for them. And if they want to contain us, that means they need to pay higher cost to achieve what we have already achieved.
Right.
And I think at the end, they will realize the best way is globalization. The best way is openness. And so we will do our effort, make some progress. We will share our progress with them.
Mm.
And at the same time, certainly, we can also share the fruit, the result of their progress. And by that, we can, you know, contribute to, you know, a better world.
You're saying we can contribute to a better world. Then where do you see China on the global economic ranking in the coming decades? Do you expect the Chinese economy to contribute a larger share to global growth? Yeah. Now it's some 30%. Do you expect like 40% or even higher?
Well, I think that I'm confident because, as I said, we can maintain about 5% or more growth in the coming years or even decade, and our GDP share is about 18% to 20% of the global GDP. So if we maintain 5% growth, we'll make 1 percentage point to the global growth. And the global growth now is at a low level. It's about 3%. Mm-hmm. So if we make 1 percentage point contribution, our contribution will be 30%. Okay. And in the future, our economic size will be bigger.
Right.
Okay. But I hope the global growth will rebound to 4% or 4.5%.
Right.
And by that, even we make more than 1 percentage point of contribution, because our economic size bigger.
Much bigger.
But, you know, if the global growth become 4% or 4.5%, then our contribution may be around 30% or even only 25%.
Mm.
But fundamentally, I think we can maintain the growth and we can make at least 1 percentage point to the global growth.
Right.
And it will be around 30%. Yeah, continuously.
Then what's the most significant implication, would you say, of China's rise or re-emergence as a global economic power for the world?
Well, I think that the most important contribution certainly to the Chinese people, because we had one of the largest population in the world.
Right.
And as I mentioned, if we can reach high income status, then the people living in the high-income country will be more than doubled. Okay. And that's good for China. But that's also good for the world.
Mm-hmm.
Because we will make the market open to other countries and provide more opportunity for them to grow also. And the other important contribution is that it will enhance the confidence of other developing countries. They can do the same thing.
Right.
Yeah. Because, as we discussed, you know, 75 years ago, 45 years ago, we are one of the least developed countries. And for other, you know, less developed countries, they also have the aspiration to become high-income country, to catch up. And the possibility for China to make this transformation within one generation, two generations, will enhance their confidence. If they have the right idea, right policy, and to have a coordinated, you know, a concerted effort in their country, they can achieve similar things. So it can enhance the confidence of other developing countries as well.
Indeed. So earlier you mentioned that China might attract many talent from other countries or foreign talent. So I'm asking this question maybe on behalf of those people. Apart from Beijing, Shanghai, or Shenzhen, which cities do you think have the biggest potential for growth in the coming decades? In other words, besides the first-tier cities, which cities in China would you recommend for the younger generations, including those from other countries who want to live and work in China?
Well, people try to have a better life.
Yeah.
Yeah. And to have a better life, they need to have a good job, right? And so if we have good jobs, people will come.
Right.
And certainly in our first-tier cities, we have very dynamic economic growth, many new jobs.
Mm-hmm.
But in the second-tier cities, I think gradually they will have those kind of opportunities. But some may be in the service sectors. For example, tourist attraction.
Right.
And in the second-tier, third-tier, yeah, some places, they have very good tourist attractions.
Do you have any names in mind?
Well, you know, now like Harbin.
All right. Harbin? I wouldn't expect that because of the tourism boom.
Yeah.
Right.
And if you go to Yunnan, to Dali, and you can see beautiful cities, right?
Right.
And they have history, they have natural resorts. And that will be, you know, a new destination for tourism.
Mm.
And so young talented, they can find a good job and to, you know, help in those regions to develop. At the same time, can, you know, create a career for them.
Mm, right? Mainly in the service sector.
Service, those in the service sectors.
Right.
But in some manufacturing sectors.
Right.
And well, research centers. because we can see, like in the advanced country, sometimes the research centers locate not in the big cities.
Right, such as Guizhou, Southwest China.
Yeah, Southwest China, they have good natural environment, and they have good telecommunication infrastructure, and that can be the research centers for new technology and a new industry also.
Mm.
So I think as long as they can maintain dynamic economic growth, tap into their competitive advantages, some may be in the natural resources, but some may be in the natural environment or good, good different environment, and that can be the source of new jobs, and that will attract the talents.
The Chat Lounge. The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
Right. Some questions about your personal experiences. You became the first World Bank chief economist from a developing or emerging economy. So what was the biggest takeaway from your experience as the chief economist and senior vice president of the World Bank between 2008 and 2012?
Well, certainly it's a privilege for me to be able to become the first economist from the developing world to take such an important job. And for me, my most important takeaway is that all the developing countries, they have the same pursuit. They always want to develop their economy, to get rid of poverty, to enhance the living standard of people, to close the gap with the advanced country. They all have those motivations.
Right.
And the World Bank also set that as a mission, because if you entering into the main gate of headquarters of the World Bank, there is a motto. A world free of poverty is our dream. And they have those kind of motivations. But if you look back, yes, we had the same pursuit, and we also make a lot of effort, but achievement is not as desirable. And I think the main reason is that, a lot of policy recommendations are guided by theories that from the advanced country.
Right.
And they look desirable, but may not practical, may not be effective, because the condition in the developing countries are different from the advanced country. And then so from what I see, it's very important need to have new ideas, new theories based on the experiences of the developing country. And to sell those kind of new understanding, new theories, and that will be more, relevant to help the developing country to achieve, realize their dreams.
Mm.
And that is also the reason why after the coming back from the World Bank, I'm so delighted to have the opportunity to, set up the Institute of South-South development and cooperation.
Right.
Yeah.
I think they also need, apart from what you said, they also need some economists who dare to think outside of the box, who got educated in developed countries, but have the ability to develop the economic model of their own. Now, on the other hand, what new connotations have you given to this position?
Well, here is that, as you said, we need to have a better understanding about how to make things work.
Mm.
And like the economic theory in the past, they only emphasize the important function of the market. However, we see a country, if we want to realize their dream of development, certainly market is very important, but they also need to have their government to play enabling facilitation role.
Right.
And we need to have a new theory to explain why we need to have market, but we cannot neglect the government.
Mm-hmm.
But also, we cannot only emphasize the government and neglect the importance of market. So we need to have a theory to provide understanding how to make the market and the state plays the organic, you know, supplementary functions.
Then do you think the new structural economics you championed is the answer?
I think that so far the new structural economics is a theory generated from the experiences in China as well as in other developing countries.
Mm.
Try to understand how come some countries, you know, have been successful, but the majority of them are lagging behind. As I said, the motivation, the goals are similar.
Right.
And every country put a lot of effort, but how come some are successful, some are not successful? And from that understanding, we come up a better, you know, theory, theoretical framework can guide our effort.
Mm-hmm.
And that is the new structural economics try to achieve. And so far, you know, I propose some kind of basic understanding, but it's still in the early stage. And we need to, you know, further develop the new structural economics as a new economic theory.
Right. But in your theory, I think there are a lot of, content are based on some Western experience, right? So some people would say your theory is the result of the application of the Confucian doctrine of the mean, you know, to some extent, a moderation or a combination of Keynesian economics and liberalism or neoliberalism. What's your take here?
Well, certainly, you know, our ideas always evolved from the idea in the past.
Mm.
You can find some trace from the past, but it always has a new connotation there.
Indeed.
So it's just not copies. And we need to put into the, you know, the new challenge we have and to find out an appropriate function for each of these institutions.
Mm.
And it's not, you know, just abstract from the idea. It's generated from the experiences, and you can find traces from the past, but it has some kind of new connotation in our time.
Then when it comes to new connotation, do you think, you know, obviously your theory has been applied in some African countries and also in Poland, which is also defined as a somewhat, to some extent, a developed economy. So why do you think they would adopt your theory in their national development?
I think that fundamentally they all had a same goal.
Right.
Try to, you know, help their country to develop further, and that is the shared motivation,
right?
And new structural economics provides some kind of alternative thinking compared to the past, and they find, you know, to have a combination of market and a state is a better way to overcome their challenges and to explore their you know, conditions and bring their country to a new stage of development.
Mm.
And I think that reason why the new structural economics is attractive to them.
Do you think what's happened in the U.S. lately, especially over the past few years, reshoring manufacturing to America, is an example in line with your theory or proves the universality of new structural economics to some extent?
Well, that is that is motivated by political or, you know, hegemony ideas.
Right.
Yeah. And since that is not consistent, the basic economic principle.
Right.
So they will pay high cost for that. And even they pay high cost for that, they may not be realize their goal. For example, they talk about, you know, attracting the manufacturing back to the U.S.
Mm.
And try to decouple from China. But as a result, you know, they find those kind of industry will not go back to the U.S.
Mm.
At the most, they will, you know, move that to other, you know, developing country. But if they move those kind of industry to other developing country, the cost of production in those countries will be higher than the cost of production in China.
Mm.
So as a result, they need to pay higher cost for those kind of goods. And that is not good for their people, right? They did not really attract those kind of jobs back to the U.S., but they pay higher cost for the good now they imported, then importing that from China.
Mm.
So that is the, you know, not good for their people, not for the, for good for their growth.
The Chat Lounge. The Chat Lounge unpacks views and opinions on hot issues in a more casual way.
You don't think it's something that maybe they learn from China, or maybe they, you know, apply your theory to their economy to make some industrial policies?
Well,
a step back,
and
maybe.
And I hear that my new structural economics will not recommend that.
Right.
New structural economics will, you need to have industrial policy to facilitate the industry which you have latent competitive advantages.
Right.
And help those kind of latent comparative advantages to become your actual comparative advantages. So you can produce the good domestically or service domestically, and you're not only share the good domestically, you can also share those good internationally.
Mm.
And that is the idea of new structural economics, and that is the idea of industrial policy that can help the country. But now they want to develop industry which go against their competitive advantages. And if they want to, you know, develop those kind of industry, they need to protect those kind of industries at a very high cost. And very often, even they want to protect, those industry may not be viable in their country.
Mm.
As a result, they make a lot of interventions at a very high cost, but they can still, they will not be able to realize that goal. As we mentioned, they want to reshoring some of their industry. For example, those kind of light manufacturing goods. But they will not be able to really develop those kind of industry domestically.
Mm-hmm.
If they want to develop those kind of industry domestically, their industry will not be competitive at all. And so firms will not have the incentive to relocate those kind of industry back home. At the most, due to the political intervention, they may move those kind of industry to some other developing country like Vietnam or Indonesia or India, but at high cost. But at the same time, even they may move those kind of assembly of those kind of product in other developing country and to export those kind of product to the U.S. But the intermediate parts still have to come from China.
Mm.
So as a result, those kind of policy have some negative impact on China, but marginally, because
right.
fundamentally we reduce the export to the U.S., but we increase the export to other developing countries.
Mm.
They produce those kind of final product. And so at the end, the negative impact on our country will be smaller than the negative impact on the importing country.
Then where can they head to then? The reason why I'm asking this question is because according to your theory, China would move toward an economy that's centered on service, right?
Yeah.
There would be a bigger share coming from the service sector. But what happened in the U.S. is that the financialization of the economy turns out to be a big problem for them. Then where can they go? Or in other words, where can China go after this industrialization?
I think that every country has opportunity to grow continuously.
Right.
If they look into the area, they have competitive advantages. And a country at a different stage of development, they have different competitive advantages. So China will grow and create a larger market also for other developed countries. Because they have some area they have competitive advantage we do not have. And under that, we are an open economy, we grow, we make our market bigger, and we provide a larger market also for other countries.
Mm.
So it's a win-win.
Right. Yeah. Maybe we'll have to wait for some decades so that we can know where we can go further in the future. Some people say you may be the Chinese economist most likely to win the Nobel Prize in economics, especially with your new structural economics theory. So have you thought about joining over 30 alums of Chicago University to become a Nobel laureate when you championed new structural economics?
Well, that never been
on your mind?
on my mind, because what I concern is that, you know, the work that I develop, the theory I develop can help our country to grow,
right,
to develop, to make our country, you know, more advanced, make our society, you know, harmony, make our life better.
Mm.
That is our goal, our idea of my, you know, my effort. And to get a Nobel Prize, you know, well, it's the judgment by other people, but it's not what my motivation.
Okay. Right.
Yeah.
You've expressed your belief we will see more and more winners of Nobel Prizes in economics, yeah, physics, and medicine coming from those who went to university after 2008, yeah, in China. Why?
Well, because, you know, economic theory, mm-hmm, is a simple economic logic. And the logic, the simpler, the better. And under the kind of situation, how can you say your theoretical contribution is a major contribution?
Mm.
You know, it does not depend on the logic of the theory.
Right.
It depends on the importance of the economic phenomena that the theory explains. But what is the important economic phenomena?
Mm.
The economic phenomena occurs in important country. Then what is the important country? Well, the global economic centers, the phenomena in those countries will be important phenomena. And if we continue our growth, as we already discussed, maybe by the time of 2030, China will become the largest economy in the world.
Right.
By the time of 2049, when we celebrate the centennial celebration of the Republic, I think China will be the global economic centers. And so any economic phenomena happening in China will be important phenomena. And in understanding the phenomena and to generate theory from the phenomena, certainly Chinese economists will have a better opportunity because we'll understand those kind of phenomena better. Because the importance of the phenomena make the theory become important. And I think our younger generation, they will have the opportunity,
right,
to deal with those kind of important phenomena and to understand the important phenomena to come up with important theoretical contribution.
Mm.
And if they can make that contribution, certainly they will be, you know, recognized and they will be awarded those kind of prizes and so on.
Right. We look forward to that moment coming at an early date. But do you have any specific names in mind that are hopeful candidates, maybe?
I think that so far we are still in this process. So
all right.
But I'm sure, you know, it's hard to pinpoint a person. But I think in the next generation, we are going to have those kind of economists make that important contribution. And I think not only economists can make those kind of contribution, our scientists can also make a major contribution and to be awarded Nobel Prizes.
Mm. But at this moment, I think all of us would agree that Justin Li Fu Lin would be the most hopeful candidate there. Thank you, Professor Lin.
Thank you very much.
That's Professor Justin Li Fu Lin, former World Bank Chief Economist and Dean of the Institute of New Structural Economics and Dean of the Institute of South-South Cooperation and Development at Peking University. If you want to hear the chat again or listen to other show episodes, find us on all major podcast platforms. Also, drop us a line if you have anything to say about the show. Just email radio@cgtn.com. I'm Tu Yun. Thank you for listening. We'll have more chat at the Chat Lounge next week. Bye for now.
Ever wondered what's actually going on in Africa through the perspective of an African? How are things really going between China and Africa? What's the narrative of this relationship? Well, get a perspective with China-Africa Talk. Hear from African diplomats, entrepreneurs, academics, Chinese natives, and more. Get on our wavelength every week to find out what's real with China-Africa Talk. Find us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, and more. We'll see you there.